Well, hello everybody, and welcome to show number 164 from Engage for Success. Today's show, rather intriguingly entitled Journey into the Circus of the Mind, so I hope you will wish to take that journey with us for the next 30 minutes. I'm Jo Moffat, I'm host for today's show, and I'm founder and managing director of Woodread. We're a specialist advertising agency, and we work with clients to help them use their brands to engage their employees and create successful internal cultures using the same sort of techniques that marketeers use with external audiences, but we use the brand on the inside. And for the next half an hour, I'm going to be joined by Tom Griffin. Hello, Tom. Welcome to the show.
Hello there, Jo. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it's good to have you. And Tom is a behavioural strategist and storyteller, and is going to be taking us on our journey into the circus of the mind. As I say, it all sounds rather intriguing and something I'm really looking forward to. So, but before we start that journey, Tom, a little bit about yourself. I believe you work for an organisation called Fourth Wave. But where have you come from? How did you get us to where we're going to be for the next half an hour?
Well, I have quite a diverse and eclectic background, really. As you said there, I call myself now a behavioural strategist and a storyteller, and so I'm used to telling my little story, if you like. But it started actually when I ran away from home. I ran away
right.
from home. Yeah, I ran
away. Joined the circus.
Did you want to, not to, actually, it should have been the circus, shouldn't it? No. In this case, it was actually I ran away from home to join the theatre. So
right.
they're fairly aligned. I'm trained at a place called the Bristol Old Vic, and a classical theatre school, and I did that for a decade or so, which is where a fascination for how we human beings work really came from.
Mm-hmm.
And as part of that journey, because I could sing and tap dance and stuff, I ended up in the West End doing musicals, and I trained my voice and ended up as a soloist in Sadler's Wells Opera, actually. So the early
right.
part of my career was all about the kind of the artistry of what it is to be a human being and the human condition. So that was a kind of that started my fascination with how it is that we human beings worked. And then I kind of, like most human beings, like a lot of human beings, I ended up falling in love.
Right.
Very nice. I know. And got married. And as part of that, I decided I ought to really settle down and become more sensible,
mm-hmm.
which for me was starting a marketing agency. Interesting there, hearing you talking about brands and brands from the inside out.
Yes.
My marketing agency was all about live communication and live experiential marketing.
Mm-hmm.
And that enabled me to get a really good understanding of how organizations work and how organizations work in pursuit of a shared goal. Similarly, of course, I had to use similar sorts of techniques that I used in the theater, because you need to understand what makes people tick, both in terms of wanting to communicate to them, but also in terms of wanting to get them to work better together. Now,
mm-hmm.
I sold that business in November 2007. And decided that to take a sabbatical. I took a 5-year sabbatical where I wanted to kind of bring together the two parts of my sort of career life, the bit that was fascinated by people from the days in the theatre and the bit that was fascinated by organisation. So I spent 5 years basically studying behavioural sciences in all their various guises and flavours, anything from a sort of applied neuroscience and even hypnotherapy on one side, all the way through to coaching, drama therapy, or those kind of things on the other side. And out of that work came this absolute belief in the fact that we human beings are extraordinary and are capable of achieving extraordinary things. And I started my consultancy called Extraordinary People with that premise in mind, to help mm-hmm. people understand more about how it is, why it is they are extraordinary, and how it is that they can start to engage with those levels of resourcefulness, both inside themselves and inside their teams and their organizations in pursuit of a shared goal, if you like. So that's my eclectic background, as it were, and it's led me to this. It led me from the theatre into the circus of the mind, I guess you
right,
could say.
Right, yeah, fascinating. I think, you know, as you were talking, I was thinking there's got to be a show in people's, or a book even, in how people's career paths were influenced by when they fell in love.
Yes, how about that? Well, the sad thing is I'm now divorced, but there we go.
Oh, well, there we are. Perhaps we won't explore that one.
Not every story has a happy ending. Well, actually, that's got a happy ending. We're great friends now.
Oh, right, good. So let's come back then. Circus of the Mind.
Yes.
What's that all about? What's that mean?
Well, I kind of alluded to it back in there in terms of we now know, over the last couple of decades, we now know more about how the truths about how we human beings work than we ever did before. You know, what makes us sentient is not just that we're aware, but we're actually aware that we're aware. You know, that kind of stands us out a little bit. Now, thanks to the advances in things like applied neuroscience, applied behavioral science, the work of people like, say, Daniel Kahneman and behavioral economics, or mm-hmm. Thaler and Sunstein with their work, Nudge, a lot of that sort of work, we're now not just aware that we're aware, we're becoming aware of how we're aware. And that's incredible. What that means is that we're now starting to get the kind of the instruction manual, if you like, on how we work. And that to me is incredible, because if you think about it, whenever we get, I don't know, say you've got a new car and it's got a new sat nav in it and you're about to go on a long journey, what you'll do is you'll spend a good bit of time working out how your sat nav works. You know, how do I put in the route I want to get to? How do I avoid the motorways? How do I change that annoying voice? All that kind of stuff.
Do we?
Some of us do. or like an app on your phone. You know, oh, right, how does that work?
Yeah, I know.
You spend a bit of time working out how it works. And in doing that, then you're better able to have it do the things for you that you want it to do. In the case of the sat-nav, it's just better able to get you where you want to be.
Hmm.
Now, the question is, and it's an interesting question for the listeners to ask themselves, how much time have you spent actually being curious about how you work and what might become possible for you if you did just spend even as much time as you spent learning how a new app or your sat nav works? And that's I spent 5 years doing that. And it starts to reveal some really powerful insights into how that works.
So it's quite interesting. So I mean, your premise is that actually we invest far more time in understanding our latest gadgets and gizmos and the kit in our lives than we actually do around ourselves and the people we work with. And if we just spent a fraction of that time, it would pay dividends then.
Yeah, I absolutely. And the thing is, as well, this is all very new stuff. We didn't used to be able to do it a couple of decades ago. A couple of decades ago, this kind of curiosity or this kind of work was in the field of kind of motivational this, that, or the other, or kind of, you know, think positive, law of attraction, all this kind of ethereal sort of stuff.
Mm.
But now what we've got is we've got empirical science that supports it and backs it up. You know, I mentioned earlier the work of Daniel Kahneman. I mean, only in 2002 did he won the Nobel Prize for Economics. Now, he's not an economist, he's a psychologist. But what he discovered was the way in which we make choices that we make, the vast majority of those choices actually happen at a subconscious level. You know, and he realized that when we think we're making a choice, what's actually happening is we're simply becoming consciously aware that a choice has already been made at a subconscious level. And he called those things cognitive bias. In other words, we're predisposed to a good example. A good example of this.
Give me an example.
So,
that'd be lovely.
They did a study in North America, in the suburb. And they went to two communities, Community A, Community B, and they asked both communities if they would put a drive safely sign in their garden, a big sign, drive safely. Now, Community A, somewhere in excess of 70% of people said yes, they'd put that big sign in their garden. Community B, like less than 10% said. Now, the only difference was 2 weeks earlier, they'd gone around to Community A and asked Community A if they put a small postcard in the window saying drive safely. Now, as a result of having been asked that 2 weeks before, they were dramatically more likely to accept a great big sign in their yard. Now, that's a cognitive bias called consistency. In other words, if a request that you make of somebody is consistent with something, albeit smaller, that they have done before, then they're much more likely to say yes to it. So even in that small example, you start to get an understanding of if we use the way in which we're built and designed to work, then it's much more likely that we can help people make choices that are better for them and more empowering for them.
Right. Yeah. No, I can see that. So taking that on a step, then what are some of the practical applications of that newfound understanding and newfound learning inside organisations in the business context?
Well, let's think about kind of communication and engagement from that point of view, and you know your business there is in a sense all about communicating and engaging people with messages that they believe, that they feel are personally relevant to them in such a way that it affects their behaviour, affects what their beliefs, it affects their values, and it affects what they do. If you think about communication and what defines great communication, it's not your message, it's not what you say. Great communication is defined by what people believe and what they do. And even and the most important part of that is the what they do.
Mm-hmm.
Because nothing happens in any organization, nothing happens anywhere in the world unless somebody actually does something. It's our behaviors that are the real thing. As you all know this from your working with cultures and brands inside organizations, you can have as many posters on the wall with kind of our values or what we espouse, or as many beautifully designed logos as you want. They don't make any difference. The only difference is actually made by what somebody does as a result of that piece of communication. Mm-hmm. So the real application, if you like, is that this insight enables us to be able to start where we should be starting, which is at the point of behaviours. What is it that we want people to do? That, I think, is the thing that unlocks the potential of this, that ability to be able to put our attention where it needs to be. Because if you think about it, you can go to any organisation and you could say, in order to be more profitable, what would you need to see people doing? What would you need to hear people saying? And they would tell you. They would be able to tell you really quite clearly, if we've got people doing this or if we've got people saying this, then this would be the financial impact of that. They can be really quite clear about that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thanks to advances in applied behavioral science and indeed the practices of what's rather fancily called heuristic science, the science of where you put in stimulus and you study and see exactly what happens as a result, thanks to that, what we can now do is we can say, okay, what's the behavioral outcome that you desire? Okay, that's what you want to see people doing. And you know, if you get people to do that, you know what the commercial impact will be or what the impact will be on your on the strategy you have in place. Okay, but if you want them to do that, what do we know as behavioral scientists, what do we know around what stimulates and provokes people or inhibits people from doing that? So once we identify what are the behavioral insights around the desired behavior, we can then put in place stimulus and the relevant triggers in order to make it much more likely that people will choose to do that rather than choose not to. So in a sense, you take the guesswork out of it and you put science in its place.
Mm-hmm. Okay, get that, understand that. I'd argue that I have to take issue with you when you say that none of the imagery and the graphics and the pictures on the wall make any difference. They do, they're not as important as behaviours. They help the stimulus. They start to kind of rent some space in people's minds. So
absolutely.
I just to say that point.
I completely agree with you. Obviously, I intentionally put it in quite a strong way, but it's become so easy to think, there we go, we've got the words, and we've got the job done. All we need to do is to share that with people, and that's it, done.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, and unfortunately, people fall into that trap all the time, don't they? And more tragically, very often, some of those images and words on the walls have not been drawn from anywhere other than just sort of plucked out of the air with no kind of grounding in the organisation's brand or strategic objectives or being
drawn
from what the people themselves think and what's true about the business.
Exactly, so that. They become sort of aspirational. Wouldn't it be great if we could, rather than actually can we?
And people don't, they're not relevant to people, they don't feel real. And so they don't engage with them, do they?
I often talk about this from the point of view of working from the inside out, you know.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, get to engage people. I have this process called engage, align, elicit. Step mm-hmm. one is engage people with where they're at. What are their beliefs? What are their values? Because they'll talk to you till the cows come home about what they believe in and what they value. And once you stir and stimulate their beliefs and their values into life, then the next stage is to create an alignment. Align where they're at with where we're all going as an organization. And once you've got that alignment, then you're in a place where you can do the third stage, which is elicit their behaviors. And the word elicit is really important, and it goes back to this belief that I have that we human beings already contain within us and around us all the resources we require. The real trick is to elicit those resources from within the individual, so they already feel very much a native, if you like, to the kind of behaviors that you want to see and hear in your organization.
Absolutely. I like that word, feel a native to the behaviours. That's quite nice. I might have to steal that, Tom.
Please steal it. Well, all too often, and then sort of it's very, you know, very, very current language, all too often we make our own employees an immigrant to their own culture, because we say, this is what we want you to be like. See that word over there? That's what you need to be like.
Yeah, we kind of force them into, we kind of try to shoehorn them into a sort of shape that isn't necessarily one that's true to them or the business. So it's interesting. So when I get all that, I totally get everything you're saying, and you know, clearly, well, I think personally we're on the same page, and I imagine that a lot of our listeners will probably, you know, be with you in terms of what you're saying as well. But you've sort of talked about things. You've used terms like behavioral economics, neuroscience, and other sort of things that you took you 5 years to explore and understand and really get to get a sense of the validity of. But that all sounds quite complex. I mean, are there how straightforward is it for people to understand what's going to make their people tick? You know, is it something that involves enormously complex processes?
No, because the great thing is actually we're all already experts in this, because we're all already human beings. Now it might be that we're not tuned into that, but it's like a radio. A radio has got every single radio station that airs in this country on it at any one moment. All it needs to be done, all they need to know is, what's the frequency? Well, how do I dial into it? It's all already there. And what I tend to find in my work, when you start working in this, you know, at this level, people very, very quickly get dialed in, very, very quickly get tuned in. Why? Because we're dealing with the fundamental truths of how we human beings actually work, which is necessarily really rather simple. Yes, we put a whole bunch of material external stuff around it, which fuzzies it up and makes it look like it's complex, but in reality it's extremely simple. I guess you could say like a computer. A computer seems to be extraordinarily complex, and at one level it is, but at its most fundamental, it's just binary. It's a one or a zero, and it's just a billion different connotations of that deliver us our ability to create a PowerPoint, write a Word document, or calculate something on an Excel spreadsheet. So if you can recidify, if you can get back to what's the simple things, the simple truths that we all share in common, now you're at a level where we can start to work. It's like like in, say, negotiation technique. You know, in classic negotiation technique, the art is to not start with where you are, but to chunk up to where you meet. What are the things that we have in common? And now let's work toward as far down that pyramid as we possibly can, and create some common ground. So the simple it really does boil down to, you know, as I've been working through and on this stuff, it boils down to three simple questions, and I kind of alluded to them before. You simply have to ask yourself is, what's the desired behavior? What is it that I want to see or hear? And that's what it comes down to. What do you see, hear? What do people say or do? Those four things, see, hear, say, do. What do you want to see more of in your organization in order to dot, dot, dot? What do you want to hear more of in your organization in order to dot, dot, dot? So step one, what are the desired behaviors I want? Mm-hmm. Step two is, okay, so what are the behavioral insights that we now have about around that? And the great news is you don't need to be a behavioral scientist to be able to do that. You just need to know one. Well, you need to, because there's all that research
like,
is there.
Like what? Can you give an example there, Tom? What do you mean by a behavioural insight?
So a behavioural insight would be, think of a nice example. Okay, here's an example. In 2008, the UK government set up a unit called the Behavioural Insights Team, often called the Nudge Unit.
Oh, yes.
One particular challenge they had was the HMRC had difficulty reaching a core group of 5,000 people who refused to answer their letters or put in their tax returns or anything. So HMRC went to the Nudge Unit, who used one of Kahneman's cognitive bias called relevance. And what they did was they changed the colour of the envelope from brown to white and had somebody literally handwrite a note on the outside of the envelope that said, David, you really need to open this. As a result of that, making the letter, in other words, relevant, much more relevant to that individual. This is addressed to me, it's got my name on it, there must be something important in this. As a result of that, they increased response rates by over a third and yielded a return on investment of 200-1. So there's a perfect example of how using an insight as to how we human beings do or don't respond fundamentally changes how people behave.
There are lots and lots of them, and I'm sure
people did sort of a search into some sort of cognitive bias or stories around cognitive bias. They'd be able to harvest some really, and there's some really fun ones, ones in there too.
We're as an agency at Woodrigg, we're part of the IPA, the Institute of Practitioners in Advertising, and they've done a lot of work around behavioural economics and some of those key themes, things like valuing something today much more than you value the loss of it tomorrow, for example, it was really quite interesting. So you've given us two of those questions, and I interrupted you, I'm afraid. So
the first
question to ask is what's the desired behaviour to achieve whatever my objective is? What do I want to see? What do I want people to hear? You know, what do I want to hear them doing? What do I want people to say? And what do I want them to do? And then the second question was what are the behavioural insights? And then the third question, Tom.
And the third question is what are the behavioural triggers? So in other words, what will trigger that behavioural insight and therefore the behaviour? So here, for example, so in other words, what happens is rather than going, to use the example I've just used with HMRC, rather than saying, here's the creative brief, guys, we've got 5,000 people who won't answer our letters, come up with another way of getting them to answer the letter, that's not the brief. The brief is, we know that people will open letters if they think that they are more relevant to them, what is it that's your creative brief? So what can we do? And so the behavioural trigger becomes white envelope and handwritten note.
Right. Handwritten note and white envelope. They're not relevance. That's the insight. Is that
exactly
respond.
That?
Okay.
That effectively the behavioural insight becomes the brief to the creative. If you could look at this the other way, you could look back at campaigns that have been phenomenally successful, and you could pick anyone you want. And what you could do is look at that, and that was phenomenally successful because, let's say, there was some strong strategic insight and there was a fantastic creative team on it. If you can look back at that and you can interrogate it from the perspective of behavioural insight, and you can decode why it was that was so successful, because you'd be able to understand, they're tapping into this. The reason it was so successful is because they tapped into this behavioural insight, and they're therefore able to trigger the desired behaviour,
I get what you're talking about, and a lot of what you're talking about chimes very much with the language that we would read as a creative agency and people in the advertising space would use, and obviously you come from that same area as well. But if I'm an HR director in an organisation, How do I go about trying to uncover some of these things? How do I learn about them, and how do I prove them? How can I prove to, say, my cynical FD that there's some worthwhile investment to be made here, and that I can demonstrate some kind of return on that?
Well, again, it's incredibly simple, because mm-hmm. you start with Stephen Covey, with his 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, his habit number 2 is begin with the end in mind. And similarly, you begin with the end in mind. Okay, what is the what behaviour can I identify that if we're looking here, say, at sort of how can I demonstrate a return on investment? How can I actually demonstrate that this will shift the business, this will move the needle? Okay, identify the desired behaviour where you've got a really strong correlation with whatever the needle is you're looking to move, and let's say let's call it increased sales, just for sake of argument. It keeps it nice and easy. So if we can get our sales agents to understand the detail of our products better, and in other words, we can hear them being articulate about our products, then we know that they will be able to communicate that to the client, and then we will sell more products. So you've got a very clear behaviour. Mm-hmm. You hear people being articulate about the products. So you say, okay, that's my desired behaviour. Mm-hmm. What's my current behaviour? What's the current behaviour that I'm noticing? What am I hearing? I'm hearing people being very generalised about our product. I'm hearing people being inaccurate about our product. And I'm hearing people being disingenuous about our product. Okay, mm-hmm. So that's the current behavior. Now, what I need to do is I need to move people from the current behavior to the desired behavior. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to put in different types of stimulus, different types of triggers, and I'm going to see what happens as a result. So you end up creating what we call a behavior map, a mm-hmm. map that takes you from current behaviors to desired behaviors, and you might call them kind of key behavior indicators. And what I'm able to do, and again, it's using the disciplines of applied behavioral science, whereby you put in some stimulus, you understand the current behavior, you put in some stimulus, you observe the resultant behavior, and therefore you can very accurately determine the extent to which your stimulus has or hasn't changed behavior. And you can keep doing that and refining that until you have effectively, if you like, codified what are the triggers that most readily and most swiftly move us from current behaviors to desired behaviors. And therefore, particularly, say, for instance, if you're in a larger audience or a larger organization or a segmentable organization, you can actually run control groups. So you can say, well, here's current behavior. Community A are going to be in the program, community B aren't. And then you can mm-hmm. you can very accurately compare the effectiveness, accounting for any other external or environmental impacts that might or might not have occurred during the course of the study.
So you would argue then from that actually it's kind of testing various scenarios to be able to then measure the relative effectiveness of them before then expanding on one of them or two of them that have been.
Yeah, that would be a great way to go, wouldn't it, just to establish a small pilot? And you can do it, if you think about it from our point of view, in terms of research and focus groups, we're used to being able to extrapolate from really rather small samples of sort of, a focus group of 8 or 10. Clearly, depending on the nature of the activity, you can put in different types of research, of evaluation models, in order to help, but because it's about behaviours and you can see behaviours and you can hear behaviours, it becomes eminently measurable because you can measure what you can see and you can measure what you can hear.
Yes, and that is why behaviours are really the only thing that matters at the end of the day, aren't they?
Exactly, and everything else is a stimulus for that, and the more accurate that stimulus is, the more focused that stimulus is, then the more likely it is that you're going to achieve the result that you want.
Great. Tom, thank you very much. Our 30 minutes has whizzed by, as it does, but I feel that, very, very nearly at the end of our show. So thank you very much indeed for joining us. I've certainly enjoyed journeying into the surface of the mind. So thank you so much for sharing those insights. I guess there's an awful lot more to say, but we're not going to be able to do that today. But thank you very much, everyone, for listening. Tom, thank you for being with us.
A real pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye now.